hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the great thing ain't all to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to you. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside of me. Just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down real life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to you. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada and the United States of America. Sorry, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Now, over the last couple of programs, I've talked about a shooting that occurred over the weekend in the city where I used to live, in Mississauga, and how sparse the reporting had been. We were told that in a townhouse complex, there was a courtyard. A ice cream truck had pulled up into the courtyard, and to the courtyard, a number of people had come out to buy ice cream from the ice cream truck, and there was about 6:30 that evening. Meanwhile, at the other end of the courtyard, a little courtyard, was some people were filming a rap video. A truck came up, or some vehicle came up, and seven people got out. They were dressed in dark clothing, and they opened fire with semi-automatic weapons. And when all the shooting was through, six people had been hit with over 100 rounds. 100 rounds or more had been fired. Six people had been hit. One, a 13-year-old boy, was killed. One, a 54-year-old woman, was injured. And let me think, and that's about all that we were told, except the interesting fact that the shooting was at random, and six injured people, five injured people and the one dead, had nothing to do with the shooters. They were not the intended victims. Well, that's pretty sparse information, and that's about what you expect from the lamestream media. Report the next day revealed that where the shooting had taken place. And of course, balls begin to click drop into place. It took place on Darcel Avenue, apparently, and that's in a very heavily Jamaican area in the extreme north east portion of Mississauga near the airport, what used to be the town of Malton. Okay, but still we're told, and the further detail that emerged was that the police now had a motive. But what that was, well, we were not privileged to know. Of course, what's being covered up is that this is black-on-black crime. That is the salient thing. The vague press reports, which are deliberately vague, needlessly spread fear. People might quite rightly think, well, I can't go anywhere in Mississauga. I mean, I could be shot down. Dead. I'm an innocent member of a crowd. I might be going to buy ice cream from an ice cream truck, and I could be gunned down collateral damage. Those, of course, would be very. They might be understandable, but those would be very erroneous conclusions. And that's highly unfair. So why is the reporting the way it is? Well, I'll tell you. The fact is that almost all of the violent crime by which murder, armed robbery, or rape, to be quite accurate, about 70 to 75% of that involves blacks, usually as the perpetrators and the victims. And that will be in the GTA, or the Greater Toronto Area. Blacks constitute about 7% of the population in the city of Toronto. So so violent crime is committed way out of proportion by blacks to their share of the population. Well, that's an inconvenient fact, isn't it? And that goes against, well, one of the chief dogmas of the gospel of cultural Marxism, which is that all people are equal. And with a further addendum, and that is the result should be equal. So blacks constitute about 6 to 7%, about 7% of the population of the city of Toronto. Well, about 7% of the violent crime ought to be committed by blacks, right? But that's not the case. And one might point out that the disproportionately criminal element among blacks isn't unique to the Greater Toronto Area. It's a figure that would hold true throughout the United States, in the Caribbean, and in England. It's just a fact. And there's a book brought out by Jared Taylor's organization, American Renaissance, about 15 years ago, called The Color of Crime, and analyzing FBI statistics in the United States and coming up with just that conclusion. Blacks are disproportionately involved in violent crime. Okay, well, that's a very inconvenient conclusion. And so what are lying establishment does, with a good deal of connivance from the police force, is to set up a false bogeyman, and that is gang violence. That is, we are told, the problem, according to the mayor of the city of Toronto, gang violence. I don't dispute the fact that probably the seven individuals, of course, we're not told what they looked like, although they do know they were wearing dark clothing. It was daytime, so they could have been seen. They're, of course, black. It turns out they are from a rival gang to the individuals who are making the video, and for reasons unbeknownst to anybody, they open fire, trying to kill the people making the video, but were such bad shots, they end up wounding, I guess it's five people who are milling around waiting for the ice cream, to buy ice cream, and killing one. So it's black gangs, not gang violence, but violence perpetrated by gangs that are black and or Somali. I suggest there could be a bit of a distinction. Most of the black gangs are Jamaican. The Somalis are, as you know, from the Horn of Africa, and are actually Hamitic, not truly Negro. But any be that as it may. So the establishment has a vested interest in disguising the fact that the major perpetrators come from one particular group. And, well, what is their interest? Well, their interest is the facts would seem to argue with the very premise that we're all equal. No, some groups commit more crime. Now, there's a bit of background noise to disguise that, and that is that black criminality is often put down to a series of alibis, you know, racism, slavery. Well, none of these blacks was ever owned as a slave. I mean, so the slavery was outlawed in Upper Canada, that's on the present-day Ontario, in 1794. That was 73 years before Canada even became a nation. There was no white, whites did not own slaves in Canada, in Upper Canada, where I live. There was slavery, but that was among the Indians. So slavery explains nothing. Racism. Well, now, would racism prompt seven Negroes to open fire across a crowd at other Negroes? Oh, well, the crowd were Negroes, too. Well, how does racism have anything to do with that? Why would blacks, if Black Lives Matter, be trying to kill other blacks? How can that be pinned on racism? Oh, it's a discrimination. Well, the only thing I can say is that the shooting was indiscriminate. They didn't care who got shot. So one will, from time to time, hear those alibis for black crime. The other thing, of course, is issue that it raises, once one knows that it was blacks killing blacks, and once one fits that into a pattern that this was not unique. And then perhaps prompts another thought that's very politically incorrect, and that is, well, these are mostly immigrants or the children of recent immigrants. Maybe the immigration selection process wasn't all that good. Whoa, you don't have thoughts like that out there, do you? And so we have the media manipulation. And we have the fake news media. Well, I was waiting for somebody today in my car, and I guess I pushed the wrong dial. I have a couple of radio stations I generally listen to. Anyway, I did not hit the right AM radio station. I think I ended up with 960. Not sure what it is, but it's a local, it's a Toronto area radio station. And there was an East Indian talking at some length about this shooting. And I must say, he actually made some sense. So he's talking about the shooting, and he said that the observation had been made that ever since the province had outlawed carding, that the instances of gun violence had shot way up. Now, that was interesting. And then he mentioned the carding had been dropped after years of vehement protest by Negroes and some white scalawag fellow travelers, because carding racially profiled certain minorities, so they say. Anyway, well, you might ask, well, what's carding? And I made mention of this earlier today on the weekly show that I appear on as a co-host, and that's the Ethno Stick. And you might want to check that out, YouTube, and put in Ethno State, and you'll get to hear us. Ken, the producer, and one of the hosts is Ken Givenan. The chief host is William Johnson of the American Freedom Party, myself, and then we usually have a guest. Anyway, I made that point today on the Ethno State. The point was this: carding refers to the practice of police of stopping people and just asking for identification and asking questions like, where are you going and where are you coming from? It's not an arrest. And carding, the police would often note down the name of the person and so on. Negroes claim that they were disproportionately carded. Police might ask a person, card a person, because they felt that they were perhaps in the wrong place or were acting suspiciously. You know, an individual, let's say a black, loitering around a parking lot, might be suspected of perhaps planning on stealing a car. Now, the police can't arrest the person just for standing around, nor should they. But if they go up and ask for identification and so on, there's a certain, we've got our eye on you factor. Furthermore, they now have an identification. So if, when they leave, and you know, half an hour later a car is stolen, one of the first people they may come looking for is, you know, T-Sean, Jones, who was seen lurking and loitering around the park. Also, if in the course of questioning the person, just asking them for their identification, the police happen to notice a bulge, I was going to say in T-Sean's pants, but well, let's be a bit more specific. Let's say a bulge in his jacket, which they assume is not some errant muscle. They might have, therefore, reasonable and probable grounds to search T-Shawn and come up with an illegal handgun. Anyway, the thinking was that that this actually allowed the police to zero in on potentially suspicious people, and it had a certain, I don't want to quite say intimidating factor, but it had a certain, it kept these people under the impression that they were being watched, and it somewhat improved the bad conduct, and gun violence was down. Since carding was abolished, now blacks do not have the black gunmen in the gangs, which are black gangs, no longer have so much to fear from going running around carrying illegal handguns. And of course, the idiot mayor of the city of Toronto, although this didn't happen there, has been hollering for a ban on handguns, and or more anti-handgun legislation. And the trust fund kid, we're now in the middle of a federal election, Justin Trudeau has promised that his government might look at granting cities the power to outlaw the possession of handguns within their city limits. I doubt they actually have the right or the power to do that, but anyway, that's another line of thinking. Now, just to emphasize how daft that is, would Tishon, the gunman, or a gunman, member of a black gang, he's already prepared to carry a handgun illegally. You see, you've got to understand, it's almost impossible to get a carry permit in Canada, other than to carry the handgun from your home to the gun range or to a gunsmith or a competition. With 99.99% certainty, I can say none of the handguns used in the shooting on Saturday night were legally possessed by the shooters. Neither legally possessed, and absolutely certainly, even if they'd had a legal ownership permit, they had no permit to carry. So already the individuals are ready to break, well, at least three laws. Attempted murder, illegal possession of a handgun, illegal transportation of a handgun. Now, would one more law, guns are outlawed here, would one more law phase them? Oh, well, I'm not allowed to own a gun here in the city. All right, well, I won't carry a gun. I won't go and shoot somebody. Well, the obvious thing is that these people are already outlaws. They're already people who don't obey the law. I mean, otherwise, why would they be going around trying to shoot somebody? So people who don't obey the law are not likely to suddenly obey one more law. So even this East Indian commentator was commenting on the fact that maybe it might be time to rethink the prohibition on police carding. And that the unholy howl that arose is that sometimes Negroes felt that they were being targeted simply because they were Negroes. It might be a little more subtle than that. I doubt that very many 75-year-old Negroes were carded. The police card or approach people who are in the perhaps age bracket or ethnicity bracket that commits a disproportionate number of crimes. And that's obviously young people, people from, say, 15 to 30, and regardless of race, are the ones most likely to commit violent crime, rather than, let's say, a 75-year-old gentleman of whatever background. So by the practice of carding, the police approached individuals who might be up to no good. Not necessarily that they were. This is not an arrest where the police have to have reasonable and probable grounds. This is simply asking for identification. Did they approach blacks more often? I think the statistics might be somewhat uninformative. The police claimed that they didn't. Blacks claimed that they did. Blacks claimed, several people, you know, Negro lawyers complained, here I am a university grad with 2 degrees, I'm a professional, and I'm pulled over and the police want to see my identification. It often turned out that they indeed, were the type of person they described, but they were driving in a largely white neighborhood and there'd been break-ins. Now, being carded doesn't mean you're arrested. The police don't drag the individual out of the car, slap the handcuffs on, and beat him up and take him down to the cells. No, the person was simply asked for identification. And the justification would be, you seem to perhaps be in the wrong neighborhood. And this is always a matter of playing the odds. Likely, if there is crime in that neighborhood, it would be committed by somebody who isn't normally resident of that neighborhood. And you fit the profile of somebody who might be like that. Not that you are, but you might be. Anyway, for this minor inconvenience and the grievous hurt it did to the Negro community, the answer, if we had a honest discussion about race, is simple. Look, your community commits a disproportionate number of violent crimes. Yes, you do deserve a closer look. And if the day comes when blacks commit a disproportionately fewer number of crimes, well, then the police carding will switch to other demographics, right? I'm not saying that 75-year-old white males never commit a violent crime, but on the average, very, very few do. And so it makes little sense for the police to approach them, all things being equal. Anyway, if we actually had race realism, as Jared Taylor of American Renaissance says, we would have a lot more practical policing. Race realism recognizes that race is a factor. Some races behave better than others in certain circumstances. Intelligent policing takes that into account. Intelligent policing tries not to waste its time unlikely lines of inquiry. Why? Well, because it just isn't very smart. If we had race realism in terms of policing, if the police were allowed to concentrate their efforts on the likely perpetrators of crime, more crime would be solved and faster. Also, in terms of enrolling the help of the general public, the prissy descriptions that are fake news media, and it is fake news. When the daily press reports crime in such a way that it misleads people, it's every bit as fake and a whole lot more dangerous than a story that perhaps said, last night Elvis Presley was seen at Tim Hortons donut shop in Malton, Ontario. That's obviously fake news. Given that example, probably very, very few people would believe it. And even if they did, it's relatively harmless. But by failing to inform us fully of the nature of a crime, or the suspected perpetrators of the crime, or the place of the crime, the people draw the wrong conclusion. Well, about a week ago, Canada got its first outlet of the big American fast food chain, Chick-fil-A. Now, Chick-fil-A is incredibly prosperous, incredibly popular, despite the fact that there have been any number of attempts to boycott it by Christian haters, and of course the abortion and the LGBTQ lobby. Why? Because the owner of Chick-fil-A is Christian, observes Christian principles in the store, and funds a number of anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ agenda groups. Well, that has earned them the never-ending enmity of the LGBTQ lobby and the abortion lobby in the United States. And I'm told that any time a Chick-fil-A franchise opens, there are attempts to boycott it. There are protests outside designed to drive off customers and so on. But, and this is a very interesting thing, these boycotts do not work. Chick-fil-A continues to prosper, and I suspect very much because of the product. Now, I can't say that of my own experience. I've never eaten there. Well, then, an outlet opened in the center of the city a week ago. Would it be? Yeah, about 10 days ago. And there was a protest all weekend long by the LGBTQ crowd and their supporters, and some would lie down on the sidewalk and would-be customers have to step over them, but it didn't deter them at all. Well, last, on the 12th of the month, an article appeared in the Toronto Star. Chick-fil-A is opposed to my existence. Oh, really? By Andrew Wheeler. And Andrew Wheeler is the editor of something called Shout Out. And he talks about I'll read part of his whine. This past weekend, I saw something that made me unexpectedly queasy. A young woman slurping soda out of a fast food cup. It upset me because it was a Chick-fil-A cup. Chick-fil-A is an anti-LGBTQ too. sometimes they add in two. That's two-spirited. That's supposedly what North American Indians call homosexuals. But anyway, okay. LGBTQ organization. Not just because the founder publicly opposes same-sex marriage. He believes in a biblical definition of marriage. But because company profits are donated to charities that oppose and marginalize queer people, especially queer youth. Now, none of the groups Chick-fil-A donates to marginalize homosexual youth. They've already marginalized themselves. These groups, though, refuse to accept them as normal, and because they're not normal. Goes on to say, young queer people are unusually vulnerable to depression and suicidal thoughts. They often struggle to find support in their own communities and even in their own families. They're not miserable because they're queer. They're miserable because of the stigmatization of queerness by family, church, and society has left them lonely and ostracized. Well, of course, he's quite right that homosexuals have an unusually high rate of depression and suicide. But it's perhaps a result of choosing a deviant lifestyle. Despite the fact there are homosexuals communities and all of that, despite the fact that they are fawned over by the mass media, that we have a prime minister who never misses a gay pride parade if he can possibly do it. Mr. Wheeler refuses to see the moral wrong of practicing homosexuality, which does lead to a whole lot of unpleasant side effects. They're miserable because people will not accept it and love them, and because the people they should be able to turn to are often the most likely to harass, harm, and abuse them. You mean their own family? Come on. Harass, harm, and abuse them? That's not where homosexual violence comes from. LGBT activists protested Chick-fil-A opening on Friday, but people were happy to cross the protest line. Some also tried to tell protesters that they weren't bad people. A lady yelled, you think I'm homophobic? I have gay friends. One man told me he voted for Trudeau. Where it shows that he may have had the good sense to eat a Chick-fil-A, but that his electoral instincts aren't to be trusted. A smirking guy hiding behind large sunglasses insisted that McDonald's is just as bad. Anyway, so a lot of the people weren't too sympathetic to the boycott. And they were just there because they wanted good chicken. Anyway, he says, we make choices though all the time. This one isn't difficult. I will not support a company that ideologically is opposed to my existence and that uses the money spent there to campaign against my existence. No, the whining homosexual isn't the groups that Chick-fil-A supports are not campaigning against his existence, but against his practice and against the insistence of the LGBT lobby that they be accepted as that they be approved in their choices. You know, we have to approve the fact that if two of them make a commitment, that that's a marriage. We have to approve the fact that they might want to adopt children. That's what, you know, we cannot do. So he goes on to say, of course, people are not just going to Chick-fil-A to eat fried chicken. They're eating fried chicken spitefully. They're defiantly standing in line with all the other free thinkers because they've been asked not to. Well, that's an interesting point. Maybe we are, or a lot of Canadians, are absolutely sick to their gut about being pushed around by one minority lobby or another. And I think there probably would be people who were hearing that there was going to be a protest against Chick-fil-A thought, well, by gosh, I'm going to go and have one of those chicken sandwiches. I'm sick of the homosexual lobby forcing its views down my throat. They know that going to Chick-fil-A hurts queer people, but they never thought much about queer people before, and they're not going to start now. It's a strange form of identity politics, where the identity is asshole. Now, that's not a very nice way for this whining homosexual to refer to the straight community. The line to get Chick-fil-A is an asshole pride parade. And this kind of gets to the mindset of the LGBT lobby, or many of the people in that lobby. If you are part of the straight community, particularly if you are proudly heterosexual and don't feel bound to praise or go out of your way to affirm LGBT practices, well, then you're an asshole. You see, gay pride, that's good. Heterosexual pride, you're an asshole. Now, the word asshole does not appear in the article as such. It's in quotation marks A hyphen hyphen whole. So okay, we can reasonably guess what it is. We're never going to chase Chick-fil-A out of town. In Donald Trump's America, it's a huge success. The number three restaurant chain in the country. It's going to be huge in Toronto. I find it interesting the attempt to tie it to Donald Trump. Chick-fil-A was a big success long before Trump threw his hat in the ring in 2016 for the Republican nomination for the presidency. It long preceded Donald Trump. It may be, though, that in a newly assertive majoritarian America, it's even more successful because it aligns itself with many of the values of the Trump nation. And let's see, I'm not reading all of it, but the wine continues. We can't shut it down, but if we can make enough noise, if enough people stay away, we might convince it to change its practices and stop hurting queer kids. Not hurting queer kids. It's not reaching out, perhaps, to affirm them. But why would you affirm a person in that person's folly? Chick-fil-A has released a poison into this city, which tells queer people that we're less welcome here, we're less safe. And of course, they always revert to this aspect of the wine. We don't feel safe. Well, maybe you're not quite as safe as you ought to be because you live a dangerous lifestyle, and some of the sexual practices of homosexuality, especially male homosexuality, expose you to some nasty stuff. Well, this is Paul Prong. You're on the funny side of me. Let's have something a little bit more upbeat. I'm going to turn to the son, a very successful son of a very successful and famous man, Hank Williams Jr. We'll have some Hank Jr. Tonight. This is Paul Prong, and you're on the funny side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Hank Williams Jr.
This is the coalition, demand coalition. Some folks want to ban cars, some want to get rid of Fender guitars. But
you got your first taste almost new. We played every song of Jimmy Rogers, and we sang every one of Old Hank's tune. Now every time we hear that whistle blowing, give back to Spratling in our shoes. Get a bad case of rambling and I
Linus Jr. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern time. Show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.